prepare our questions. Can I note Honorable Harris, I told you to sit behind the pillar. No. Yes. So that I should struggle to see. Honorable Harris is number one. Ma Adam. So you start with Ma Adam. Yes, I'll start with Ma Adam. Yeah. Veteran first. And then Ma Damini, followed by Honorable Tim Harris. Honorable Ross, I noted your hand in absentia. Yeah. Okay, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on the major achievements. The first major achievement that you set out there on slide 5, I think, is the training of counselors. Now my question is there follow-up training? Is the training enough? Is there an assessment tool? Because we have this service delivery protest all over the country. Then my second question is on the Neighborhood Development Partnership Grant programs. You have targeted 100 programs, and you've only met 95. What happened to the other 5 that was not met? And then, Chairperson, National Treasury has intervened in 3 provinces. So far, are they work, and when do they intend to pull back?
Thank you, Chair. In the first place, I think I need to take this opportunity, Chair, to thank the Treasury for coming to the committee and give us the information, because the information is critical. So thanks for the informative presentation, both from the Minister and the DG. Now, going for questions, I'm going straight to slide number 4, where the DG indicated that they are making a focus on value for money and shifting of resources from consumption towards infrastructure. My question is then, how far have you gone with this one? Because it's good to mention it, but have you started? And if so, how far have you gone? You have also indicated that you are trying to strengthen the efficiency in the public spending. Now, what is the program in the programs or the initiative in place so as to combat that, exactly what you are saying? And having said that, I know that the Treasury indicated to us as a committee some few months back that they were in the process of establishing the procurement office. Has that been established? If not, why not? Now, going to slide 13. The slide 13. If you look at the target that was set by the Treasury said that they want to roll out the strategic sourcing principle to 42 medium capacity municipalities. But I didn't hear the report back on that. What is the report back on that one? If you go down on page 97 on the big book, where the Treasury has established the legal establishment of the Government Technical Advisory Center. How is that the center that has been established different from the technical and management support and development finance that is in place right now in the Treasury? And if you're looking at that one, you will see that is within the program 8, and the program 8 of the National Treasury is the program that cut across. And if then it's a problem that cut across, I'm so sorry, then what is happening with my time? If it's a problem that is cut across, now you get a comment from the Auditor General saying the very same program did not have the measurable objectives, did not have the expected outcomes, did not have the program outputs, it worries me. I can believe that, yes, the department did get the unqualified report, which is good, but the Auditor General, he is about the numbers and the receipts. Now, the commitments, it doesn't look at it. It doesn't even measure it. Now, that is a concern. Now, Chairman, excuse me, because you have to run around like what Harris said. I understand that the department, its own view is that we're still realistic on our fiscal, we can achieve, and it is still sustainable. But if... on slide 14, problem 4, assets and liabilities, where the debt service cost of 2.6% of the GDP, it really worries. Because our GDP is sitting on what, 3.2, I'm not too sure. And having said that, how much of this percentage is used to service the borrowed loan? If you go to the big book, page 121, I'll go to what page? It's 137. The deviations, that the variants that have been made on the payment for capital assets of 21 million, both on program number 8, which is a problem that is raising some concerns to me, and on program 1, which is administration. Why were those variments done to the capital assets? Chair, I think one needs to come back because there are so many questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Chair. I have really four sets of questions. The first relates to the Minister's statement that he opened with. The second relates to the AG's reports in the accounting offices. The third is some details from the annexures. And the last is a few questions from the slides. So please just stop me when you think I've gone too long for the first round, and I'll finish up on the second. Chair, the Minister started by telling us he's been to an IMF World Bank meeting in Tokyo. I'm assuming that the narrative at those meetings has shifted in the last few months, where we were very concerned with global growth and the particular situation in Europe. I'm sure that high up on the agenda now was a concern that South Africa is declining faster than the rest of the world, especially in terms of the sustainability of the state finances as reflected by the ratings downgrade. Now, the Minister says South Africa is going better than we make it look, but especially when it comes to ratings, perceptions are reality. The rating downgrades will have a very big, I'm assuming, material effect on the cost of borrowing. And as the DG showed, all three main rating agencies have removed our A-grade status, and we're now kind of just above the line of junk status. I'm interested in the duality in Treasury's approach to the ratings. When we get upgraded, they talk about how it's an endorsement of government's performance. When we get downgraded, then they attack the methodology and approach of the rating agencies. I mean, surely you have to recognize on both sides that the rating agencies have a particular methodology, and when we get upgraded, we accept it. When we get downgraded, we should accept it too. So if the Minister could just explain that apparent duality. Then he spoke at length, Chair, about the bailout structures for the EU. Now that there's this question mark over our national finances as raised by the rating agencies, what bailout mechanisms exist for us? I'm assuming there's the the bailout fund that we contributed to a few months ago. I hear talk of another structure between the BRICS. Can the minister just run us through our options for bailing out our economy if we do get to that? And obviously the DA, like all parties, hopes that it doesn't get to that. But what structures exist to assist us? Then the minister spoke about the interplay between fiscal consolidation and support for growth. Now, I can see the plan for fiscal consolidation in the budget, but I can't see the support for growth. And I think that's obvious. It shows in the numbers. You know, Malaysia is growing at 5.4%, Chile is growing at 5.5%, Peru is growing at 6.1%, Vietnam 5.9%, the Philippines 5.9%. These are all economies that are very much like ours, a similar stage of development, similar sizes, but we're growing at 2%. The budget doesn't deal with the support for growth, and that shows in the numbers. So we definitely need more clarity there, Chair. Then just to run through the report of the accounting officer and the AG's report. The accounting officer talks about the hold-up of the youth wage subsidy at Nedlac. So I was just to, when you said the budget doesn't, maybe specify which budget they're referring to. Okay, Chair, the minister spoke about how budgets need to tread the line between fiscal consolidation and support for growth. I would argue that our national budget so far hasn't done that, and it shows up in the growth numbers. The national budget, that which is what the minister was referring to, the budget of South Africa. But what I'm saying is we tick the box on fiscal consolidation for now, although the rating agencies are questioning that, but the support for growth isn't showing up in the numbers. Chair, the accounting officer speaks about the holdup of the youth wage subsidy at Nedlac. I don't understand why this particular proposal needs consensus when other proposals come out of Nedlac without consensus. The labor laws, business didn't sign off on them. They came out and they're in Parliament now. Why does the youth wage subsidy have a special status? What is Treasury's reading of that? How come laws come to Parliament every day without consensus of Nedlac, but it's totally unacceptable that they come out, that the youth wage subsidy comes out of Nedlac without that consensus? There was lots of detail on the underspending of the jobs fund. I just did some high-level numbers. On average, we're giving projects 53 million rand. If it's 18 billion for created 21,000 jobs, that is around 85,000 rand per job. I understand the original forecast was 60,000 rand. It's slightly higher, but I still think it's relatively good value as far as cost per job is concerned. But Chair, the major factor is that Treasury got it 2.5 billion rand wrong in terms of their forecast. Now, that's quite a significant number. I understand you might get it slightly wrong, but that's in terms of at least an example to the other departments. When Treasury's out by 2.5 billion, that's quite a serious thing. And then, Chair, in the same regard, the AG's report is a litany of poor examples to the other departments. He says that in terms of the framework for managing program performance, 42% of targets were not time-bound. Employees performed work outside without written permission. There's insufficient evidence that bids were used for tenders of over half a million. There's no human resource plan in place. There's non-compliance with the PFMA and Treasury's own regulations by Treasury. And the annual financial statements have material misstatements that could have been avoided if there was an effective review mechanism in place. Now, Chair, I accept that we're dealing with an unqualified report here, but I think that's the bare minimum we can expect from National Treasury. These things that the AG's indicated are seriously alarming when they come from a department like National Treasury. How can we expect our colleagues in other committees to hold those departments to account on these issues when Treasury isn't even getting them right? Then, Chair, in the annexures, I'm interested in three big numbers. The one is the 15 billion guarantee for the DBSA. How long is this in place for? Is this the recapitalization that we were told about? And the fact that the DBSA has now shifted their financing focus to a more risky approach to financing low-capacity municipalities, I'm concerned that that approach might, increase the risk that 15 billion rand guarantee is called on from National Treasury. The second big number is the 60 billion rand loan to Eskom, of which 20 billion was added last year. Treasury feel this amount is recoverable? I know that Eskom is raising funds on the capital market, so I'd imagine those bondholders would be repaid before National Treasury. Similar thing applies to the Gautrain loan of $4.2 billion. Gautrain funded, as I understand it, by bank finance and a grant to the provincial government. So again, Treasury would be quite low on the list of creditors. Is that amount actually recoverable? And then last two, Chair, on that list, the Electrical contingent liability of $1.19 million. Would Treasury give guarantees to private mining companies that compete with Electrical? I mean, surely you have the states playing in a space where I would argue the state isn't involved, yet Treasury has to stand surety for amounts such as this to back up Electrical. I have serious reservations about that. And lastly, on page 211, there's a promissory note of 1 billion rand, which isn't, there's no justification for who that's going to or what it is. Can we get some clarity there? Chair, my last two points are very short. The first is that on the slideshow we were told that investment by governments and public corporations is propping up the kind of infrastructure investment side of the economy. But I can tell you from Parliament side, it's impossible to work out how much money is being spent. And we always get told these huge infrastructure numbers every year in the budget, and then it's impossible to do oversight on whether that money is spent because there's no reporting on the investment by the government and public corporations. So if we could get some of those numbers from Treasury, we'd appreciate it. And lastly, Chair, significant underspending from the Economic Policy Division of 32%, technical support underspent by 38%, and broadly, the payment for capital assets is underspent by 56%, which I think in the context of a budget where we're meant to be, where the state is meant to be investing in capital to ensure our long-term growth prospects, the Treasury underspends by 56% on their capital assets is setting a very, very poor example. Some more clarity on that, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for noting my hand in absentia. It's quite unique. Chair, my first point of information that I would like to ask you is regarding the material underspending of the vote in terms of the $2.4 billion and perhaps more information from your accounting officer. But Chair, I would like also to ask a question regarding the stronger intervention from Treasury into local government. And we've seen lately that there were interventions in terms of 2162 of the Constitution, where the funds of municipalities could be withheld in terms of the dollar allocation. Now, this is it's also a unique step, withholding funds from municipality, or indicating that it's a possibility. And I was at a meeting yesterday with a municipality where this actually, the Nala municipality in the Free State, where it could happen. And of course, we are supporting these interventions because we have to stop the theft, the corruption, and the maladministration. And I believe the strong interventions from Treasury is a step in the right direction. But it will it even be strengthened further in terms of a procurement office that the Minister alluded to earlier the year, and perhaps what are the plans in terms of the implementation of that procurement office. Chair, then just a remark also with regards to the $65 billion to Eskom and the latest $20 billion added, which I don't know whether it includes the 65 or whether it will be added to the 65, but it seems that the allocations to Eskom are somehow, or the guarantees to Eskom, although it's much needed because we need an alternative funding model as opposed to administered prices. And we agree that loans in the longer term is a step in the right direction. Also, just my question then, is it a soft loan and what would be the interest rate on that? And is Eskom not becoming a bottomless pit in terms of the delays in the construction of Medupi and Kusile? But we agree with alternative funding with as far as the Eskom and energy expansion programs are concerned. And then just a remark regarding the DBSA also. The DBSA has indicated in earlier presentations to this committee that they will be needing $110 billion for infrastructure backlogs in the country, which is a significant amount. We have now allocated $15 billion also in terms of a guarantee. Do we envisage that this amount will become much higher in terms of the challenges that the DBSA should meet as an institution that advocate that they will be on the forefront of implementation in terms of the infrastructure development? Thank you, sir.
You're the last for now.
Thank you, Chairperson, for noting me in absentia. So it is consistent, Chair. Chairperson, let me welcome the presentations and the reports. Let me start on Program 3. I would want to find out, just on the first bulletin around the introduction reforms to the provincial local government fiscal system, just on the direct more resources towards poor resource municipalities, I want to find out how do we come to the determination on also what informs that, is it service delivery or pool or population, the need and so forth and so on. I just want to get indication so that it does not create an assumption that we have not been allocating money to poor under-resourced municipalities. So at this stage in time, what also informs that? Official welcome. On the Program 8, there's a draft construction procurement standard for use by provincial treasuries to assess and improve compliance by implementing departments. I think it's highly welcome, probably even long overdue. But I want to find out what therefore becomes the time frame of that, or is it in the budgeting, when the budget starts, or in the mid-budgeting, so forth and so on. So how are you going to be able to assess that as it continues? On Program 1, administration, I'll go to human capital rather. Under human capital, we see the accounting from 55 female, 80 black, and so forth and so on. So, and it also accounts to 43 female. Chairperson, I feel that this is the time that at some point we need to shift, as much as we are accounting on the female every time when we try to create the imbalances, but I think that the time has also came wherein we need to account for the youth in unemployment, so that even if we're accounting for females or the males, because we no longer account for males, now it's only females, that this is how many as far as senior staff is concerned, but I think that it's time that we need to account on the youth employment in those percentages. That way we'll be able to bridge and check how what is the rise around the youth unemployment. The issue of us not being able to carry out the 2% target around the people with disabilities, I think, you know, it's tend to becoming a rhetoric in all departments. At some point, we need to come to the percentage. We need to achieve it at some point. It can't be that every time this is what we also keep on, reporting on, we are unable to. And we are unable to also check particularly what might be or what is the problem of us not being able to attract or rather having been able to employ people with disabilities. So I'm saying that the 2%, it has to be reached, and this is, we need to give ourselves a target. At this point in time, we should be able to achieve it. So that one is just a comment. On the DG, on the issues of personnel vacancies, you know, on the around the treasury at the AG's report around the vacancies, it shows deviations that has been observed. So I would want to find out what are really those deviations that has been said in the report itself. Is it what you're reporting around the posts that when you advertise, the HR and so forth? But I think it's a lot of money when we see such deviations, so I'm a bit worried around. On outcome expenditure, it reports on the budget allocated around that we've been able to spend 89% of the budget. And my problem is that we often don't get what therefore becomes their recourse, or rather of not being, of underspending, because I think that we've been able to underspend and this amount that has been located on the underspending. But therefore, what becomes the recourse, Minister, I'm not sure, you know, normally in other departments, it's money that is under, you know what to do with it. But in our case, where we budget, we're able to have under expenditure, what becomes, what happens to that money? And I'm sure, can I just hope that it's not going to be said that it's saving. Treasury should inform us on how they actually dealt with emphasis on the last AG's report in the previous reporting period, because I think that is not said exactly how you're able to deal with the last ones. Though raised by AG under strategic planning and performance management under on page 128 annual report, Treasury should be serious when reporting, particularly because the Employment Creation Facilitation Fund is very key and close to the youth at heart. So I feel that we're not reporting extensively around the issue of the Employment Creation Facilitation Fund. And if also, even if you can check on page 97, it doesn't say much on the last bulletin. And on page 137, annual report, why should we shift funds from capital asset amounting to 21,000? I don't know why we should do that. You know, normally there's an investment wisdom carried from Warren Buffett. It says rule number one, never lose money. And the rule two, never forget the rule one. So I want to find out. Are we able to generate money where we are sitting? And on the issue of the inflation, how is it that inflation rate is affecting our savings? You know, around the issues of the rating agency, citizens, and I will understand the effort being put by the latter speaker around to say when we are downgraded, we make issues around it. But my issue is that why is it that, you know, the appearances or durability, why is it that there isn't concurrence in the executing of their task? Probably something that one is grappling with to understand this type of sector and how it operates. But I think that is something, it's a cause for concern to say definitely this is what happens, because it's got a major impact for what happens. And we can't be happy about and excited about when we get downgraded. No one will be happy about that. It affects lives of the people. So I think that at some point it just becomes a cause for concern around. And I also would like to welcome also the R&I affirmation on the stable outlook. I think it's something that as South African we ought to be relieved at least around, not to be excited and want to understand something that is not there to understand. Lastly, the mining industry and the production of that of such has been quite stagnant. You know, service delivery protest. So I would want to find out, ministers, that in the investors, the issue of balancing interest, where are we, and what does this really mean for our own fiscus? Just some simple questions. But I think that just for us to get some comfort to say that we're still on the right track, but I would want to find out how does this really affect us, but specifically on the finances and the budgeting processes as we move on. Thank you. I will not comment on the youth basis. It's ethnic. Thanks.
Minister, DJ.
Let me thank the members for the questions and for an exciting debate. Honorable Adams. What I'll do, Chairperson, is allocate some of these questions now so that the different members of the delegation can manage with them. Training of counselors, Mr. Brown and Mr. Nomvalo, the NDPGP, I think it's Mr. Donaldson, the intervention in the three provinces. There are two provinces with interventions. The third was, let's say, a polite message sent to them. So let me start with that. The Limpopo intervention has worked from a financial point of view. If you remember when we briefed the committee previously, we said that, and sometimes memories are short, so I must thank Honorable Member Adams for asking the question. Why did we do this intervention? Because Limpopo provincial government wrote to Treasury and said, can we go and borrow, was it 2 billion rand at the time? Or just over 1 billion rand, right? And get an overdraft from a bank. We said, why do you want an overdraft? What's really going on here? And when we check, we find that at that time's current rate of spending, by the end of the financial year, they would have a deficit of 2 billion rand. And we said, that's not a sustainable financial situation. And when we look around, we see that there were challenges in other departments other than Treasury as well. And government decided to intervene in terms of the constitution. As we sit, where are we now, 9-10 months down the line, on the Treasury side, which we are responsible for, we now have a new head of department. There's some new staff appointed. There's some staff that still needs to be appointed so that we have proper cash management and proper budgeting and so on. Secondly, Treasury, National Treasury, worked with the provincial officials to prepare the budget that we are operating with now, 2012-2013 budget of the province. And that budget was prepared on a sort of surplus basis so that they could recover from some of the problems that they had and on unauthorized expenditure, amongst other things. On the other departments, there's a varied levels of success. Department of Health is doing extremely well. They've brought the service delivery situation largely under control, from what the Minister of Health tells me. There's some propaganda at the moment, let me be frank, to undermine the intervention, and that's regrettable, because I think people should stick to facts. But from what the Minister of Health tells me, there's some stability there. The drugs are where they should be. The surgical supplies are where they should be. And then clearly, people who would have been benefiting from inappropriate access to public funds, should I put it very politely, are obviously going to squeal because those funds are no longer circulating as they used to circulate. And so in South Africa, we now have a habit of trying to discredit certain things that were in fact put in place in order to cure the fundamental problem, which was you were going to run a R2 billion deficit. Similarly, you've heard about the challenges in education, some of which have been met, some of which the Minister of Basic Education is still dealing with. The Minister of Transport has just appointed a new administrator, and he's getting on top. He's new in his post, so he's getting on top of his situation. The Minister of Public Works has a team there. He met with them, I know, about 10 days ago. I haven't heard a report. But, Chair, at some stage what we could do is come to the committee and give you a more comprehensive report on the intervention, perhaps with colleagues from the NCOP as well. When will we pull back from Limpopo? Not yet, because I think the situation is not a sustainable one at this point in time. There's about 30-odd cases of that are with the South African Police Service where charges have been laid and the enforcement authorities have to pursue those. There's another 30-odd cases where disciplinary action needs to be taken. Some actions have started, others haven't started yet. So this is still work in progress. And there's a bit of a disjuncture between national authority and provincial authority in some of this, so we're getting some legal clarity on how we work. On the Free State, there's a fair amount of corrective action that's been undertaken in the Roads Department. Mr. Brown can give you more details on that. And in Gauteng, after 6 months of hard work, we've got some understanding with the Department of Health, both provincial and national, on how we're going to bring the finances of the provincial Department of Health into the right range. And there again, we've worked very hard, and so has the Minister of Health, to ensure that public services are not compromised as a result of some of the financial challenges that the province has been confronted with. We met up to about 3 weeks ago with all of the parties concerned, so we've been directly involved in many of those activities, and we should be heading towards a more stable environment in which we work. One of the challenges, the honorable members will know, in many of the provinces is that money that was intended for health and education is sometimes used to one extent or another for other things. And then we compromise basic services that our people should be getting. And what we are looking at as we move towards the next budget is how does an allocation for health remain the allocation for health? Otherwise, we'll keep looking for haircuts of one kind or another in order to complement something that shouldn't have actually happened at the end of the day. Honourable Member Tamini Duvazana, the value for money consumption to infrastructure, we are at the early stages of that. What we have realized is setting an objective is one thing, but putting it into practice requires time. So I think we're getting it into the heads of people who manage budgets and develop budgets, that this is the direction we need to go in. I think we need to make a lot more, make people a lot more aware as to why this is important. If you look at our overall budgets, there's a lot of money going into economic and social infrastructure, a point I'll come back to in a moment. So all is not lost in that regard. So we've started the process. There's a greater recognition. For example, in terms of the personnel bill, I mean, we've got the wage deals that we have, but we're now, together with the Minister of Public Works and Public Service and Administration, looking at, if you take the global amount of 300-odd billion rands, now, within that, there are any number of things that we could still get savings on. There's some work going on which we're not ready to report on yet, to look at what savings within those amounts. For example, are there still ghosts in the public service? Right? Are there still people who are taking too much of sick leave in the public service? Are there still categories of surplus workers who should be deployed in a particular area, refuse to go in that area, but you then substitute for them in one way or another? So there are any number of examples of issues that we are now working with our colleagues on to see if we can get on top of that. Efficiency in public spending, Mr. Donaldson might be wanting to comment on that. We, over the last 3 years, I think have gone quite far in terms of introducing the concept of savings, the concept of reprioritization within departments, the concept of contributing to a pool from which other programs could actually be serviced. We, at the edge of a piece of work done by the Treasury and Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, which is beginning to indicate which programs in government can be slowed down, which programs in government can be cut, which programs in government can be deferred. We're not there yet, but at least the conversation has started so that we work within the kind of fiscal envelope that we have at the moment. So there's still room for progress in this particular area. As I indicated earlier, one of my colleagues would say many still think that the South Africa is a rich country and you can spend as much money as you like at different levels in government. That's not quite the case. And I think Parliament itself has an important role in bringing this new consciousness about in terms of where we are going. The DG will report to you on the CPO, the strategic sourcing of this in respect of 42 municipalities, and the various questions asked about the technical advice area. The debt service cost, the 2.6% of GDP that you refer to, Honourable Member. This is the interest that you pay on debt. The DG will give you a more elaborate explanation, but that's actually what it costs to borrow money. Now, if we don't reduce that amount of money, that means you have less money available to deliver services. So prior to the recession, the global recession, we were doing very well in this area. The debt servicing costs were very low, so more money was available for delivering services. Basically, fiscal consolidation means that we must lower our borrowing. But people must also understand where ratings agencies come in is if you borrow, you're going to get ratings become important, the cost of borrowing becomes important, and the fact that people are willing to lend you money is becoming important as well. So there are many amongst South African ranks who think, we can borrow on the one hand, but to say what we like or do what we like, and that relationship doesn't work, particularly if it is our director general who has to go and smile, you know, in New York, in Boston, where else do you smile, and so on, in London, and say, I'm here to borrow money. So those are challenges that we have. The vironments he will also answer. Then Honorable Harris, and let me take a rest. Perhaps you could tackle some of those technical issues and then come back.
Quite a number of them. I am going to give them to the team, as you indicated or suggested yourself. Let me just start with the CPO. We are at a stage now, done a couple of things. One, we done an internal reorganization. We are not creating the Central Procurement Office from scratch, but we want it to serve a much bigger and very different purpose to the one that the institution we have had for some time has been serving. Under specialist function, we have got two sections, and one of them deals with matters of supply chain. You would have noticed that I reported on some of the changes that have been effected to regulations or to align the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act and the EEA. That the work on supply chain procurement already happens there, but there is some scaling up that we want to do and doing more and doing extraordinary things, which is what the CPO will then say. So as part of sort of the process to get to creating the Central Procurement Office in the manner in which the minister had announced, we have now split the systems part of specialist functions and left as a standalone area of work, supply chain, so that there is just there will be someone who heads that unit once all the due processes have been followed. At a very senior level to drive all of the work that relates to procurement, all the reforms and even the monitoring that we are talking about in relation to supply chain. But we have realized that the processes can take too long. We don't just approve it within our own department and conclude the process to sort of restructure the department in as material a way as this change necessity. So we have already sent an application with all the details about what the job would entail, and drawn up a job description, done the job evaluation, all of which are necessary steps to get finally to actually create the Chief Procurement Office, not Central Procurement Office, as I said, Chief Procurement Office. Now, we've done all of that and we've submitted the application, but in the interim, because we understand the urgency with which the work has got to be done, we have decided that we should advertise the position using the information on what the job will do or the office will do and so on and so forth, as I have characterized to you just now. So we have used that to say, let's create the position using what we call in government additional to the establishment, which means that it's not a permanent arrangement, and in that case you therefore don't need all the approvals as yet, so that we can have someone on a contract basis highly qualified, competent, and do the work whilst waiting for the processes. People have applied, expressing interest in the job, or shortlisted. What remains now is that we should then interview, which is the first step. Incidentally, interviewing for a position at the level at which this one is pitched, which is the DDG, then requires a panel of that comprises of political office bearers with the minister and so on. But the process is at that stage, and it's moving ahead. Definitely before the end of this year, we shall have someone in that job. But it will be an interim arrangement until the long process, which is necessary, by the way, or prescribed at least certainly, is completed, which involves an approval by TPSA. Hope that deals with that question and you know all the questions that relate to that particular issue. The strategic sourcing I'll leave to my colleagues. On the NGP, I mean some of the municipalities that fell off there, which account for the 41 million underspending on that grant. I mean, grants are. Municipalities apply for this grant, and some of them, they realize right up front, the grant has got two windows. There's a technical support, and then there's the grant which funds bricks and mortar. The technical support window, which is small, is usually used to assist municipalities that wish to tap the bricks and mortar part, but may not have the capacity, technical capacity, to prepare applications that meet the criteria and the conditions prescribed under the grant, which are approved by Parliament with the framework and so on. Now, we had a change in some municipalities around in the year in question. So what happened then was that we had instances, most of the five, we had instances where the previous political office bearers had applied and they were granted for one purpose. And then when the new people came in, they said, look, we're not sure if this is what we want to do. Can you hold on? We want to check and stuff like that. That's what sort of delayed things, that break in changes in people. Now, when that happens, I mean, it's not possible to say to people, look, your predecessor had applied for money. Take it and use it kind of thing. We can't just do it in that way. So that's what explains a significant part of that that deviation. On the question asked by the Honourable Mike Amini on GTEC, indeed, the GTEC is it's using the rules of the system to institutionalize almost in a kind of statutory basis now, Program 8. Excuse me. You are perfectly correct. It's going to be your infrastructure delivery improvement program, part of the PPP, which provides support, but not the regulatory bit, some of the financial management support programs and so on that are going to comprise this. But now done, I would almost say statutorily. You know, there's a minute that has been issued which establishes now as a government, establishes it as a government component. It's going to have a head, so-called equivalent to a DG. The reporting arrangements clarified, and so on and so forth. The program. If I've got here the strat plan, and I'm presuming that it will be covered even in the accounting officer's report. I mean, some of the targets that were set for that year would include things such as 80 technical assistance projects supported, 36 long-term technical assistance, 4 per province deployed
across all 9 provinces. I'm just using now the threat plan. That so in a way, I mean, fair enough, there will be some instances where the nature of what we wanted to achieve does not necessarily easily lend itself to quantification and attaching a time frame to it per se. In other words, if you are going to assist people and you want them to ask for help, as it is the case on a program like this, you can't determine upfront that I know 10 of them will ask for help, and out of that 10, 6 I will give them help, and I think that they will have asked by the end of April. I mean, that's not how real life works. If you are expecting that people will apply for help, you just signal that with the resources we have, we think we can help people in this area, because that's the conception of the program. But insofar as whether you are actually going to receive applications at a specific time, you can't state that upfront. But insofar as there is a continuation from previous years, you have got commitments and arrangements with provinces, like the example that I've given, then you can certainly say, we know we will deploy so many technical assistance to these places to achieve these objectives. So that's why you get those differences. And we list a range of things still under that program 8. I mean, if you go under the NDP, it's numbers only. Total number of neighborhood development partnership grant programs, 100, which is why there's that difference between 100 and 95. Total number of neighborhood development partnership grant projects under construction. So we list them, 50. I'm not making them up. It's in this threat plan. But then I'm saying, notwithstanding that most of them have got those indicators, there are some that don't have them, correctly so, in our view, as I've just explained. On environment, I would request the CFO to just touch on those and perhaps to take things sequentially, deal with the strategic sourcing and training of counselors at the same time. But not you, but behind me.
Okay. Thanks, TJ. I'll be short. The environment, we didn't take money from capital asset, literally. It was just a shift. You'll see from page 137, they always say numbers don't lie, and I agree on that. On page 137, you'll see that we've taken from program 1, which is administration, which was a question, and we've moved it to program 8. So it's a purely a reprioritization matter within the department.
Thanks, Chair. I thought when I didn't see Mr. Van Rooyen, there wouldn't be questions for the government. In the past, Honorable Ms. Adams, after an election, we would just give councillors a file that says this is the MFMA and you know, what to do and what not to do guide, right? So specifically this time we said, look here, we need to have intense kind of training and intense induction, basically, as it relates to that. Now, in terms of follow-up, how we are organized in the Treasury is we have an MFMA coordinators forum, which is placed in each of the treasuries there. So they do quite a lot of the follow-up as it relates to the work that a municipality basically needs to do. In addition to that, what we have is in each of the treasuries, they've got MFMA units. And with the part of the responsibility of those MFMA units is to make sure that the entire budget process within a municipality is basically strengthened from preparation right up to execution, monitoring, basically, etc. And part of that interaction, we hope would empower then on the job training basically to give to some of the councillors that work directly with the financial management aspects of municipalities. Where we see stronger treasuries, we actually start to see better performance of municipalities. And it is reflected actually in the Auditor General's basically report. Four of our treasuries in terms of the MFMA units are fairly kind of strong. And what we see, the level of negative audits coming out of that has actually declined quite significantly. So we're doing follow-ups in terms of that in different other ways than to call people out of the job to be able to train as it relates to that. I don't know whether you want to add anything, Freeman, on that.
Yeah, no, I think you've covered those. Maybe now that you've mentioned my name, I could assist the DG with the question that Honorable Harris raised around what he terms the litany of issues raised by the Auditor General. I'll start by saying that the National Treasurer, especially the DG, takes very seriously any issue that the Auditor General raises. And as a matter of fact, all of the items that have been raised, there is a response to that in terms of ensuring that it's addressed going forward. But I think the committee also will, when reading those items from the Auditor General, actually see from the language that this is not a widespread occurrence in the Treasury, even from the way the report is phrased. A specific example, for instance, in paragraph 24, it says the matters reported below under the fundamentals of internal control are limited to the sufficient deficiencies that resulted on the basis of the findings on the performance information. So it's not a widespread occurrence in every activity that takes place in the Treasury. The issues relating to material misstatements are issues that are, and the committee will remember that the DG was at pains explaining the issues around Program 7 last year. And those issues continue to be with us because those numbers, for instance, the issues relating to the 17 million is still there in the financial statements. So those items, until that matter is resolved, and then the DG explained when he was explaining the matters of emphasis, that there is a process that has to be followed to deal with that. And in dealing with that, once that is concluded, that item would fall off. So all of the items that appear here are not reflective. Otherwise, you would have found a very, very different audit opinion. But having said that, on all of them, there is a response that the Treasury is putting in place to deal with these matters. In the issues, for instance, around performing remunerative work, the framework itself that governs this in government has got a weakness, until that weakness is addressed, we have to come up with a compensating control in the Treasury, which has been suggested, and that's being implemented as we speak. So going forward, I do not expect to see this, even though the framework has not changed. But what the Treasury is putting in place to deal with this particular issue will ensure that this doesn't happen going forward. So all of those items are isolated matters as opposed to things that are of are widespread in the organization. If they were, they would have resulted in the modification of the basic opinion of the Auditor General. But even though they are not widespread, the Director General has got a response to each one of those in terms of how they should be avoided happening in the future.
Thanks, Freeman. Let me just deal with a couple of other questions before I invite Mrs. Holstead to quickly deal with questions relating to SOEs and debt. The Honorable Harris was raising the question about not seeing the expenditure, capital expenditure, that we say will lift the productive capacity of this economy and accelerate cross-capital formation. The numbers
I mean, we publish the numbers in the budget in the first instance. And usually we also show actual expenditure for the past 3 years. And those actual expenditure figures are real. That's the sort of overall kind of broad response. But you can find these numbers. If you go to the quarterly bulletins of the Reserve Bank, they summarize them, the spending numbers of corporations. You can one can easily find them in the annual reports of the state-owned entities. Of course, Eskom will publish only their numbers, Transnet only their numbers, but in the quarterly bulletins of the Reserve Bank, you would see an aggregate number, spending by corporations and spending by government. So it's the past numbers exist in reality. The forecast ones are also real because they represent work that's contracted in many instances and so on. I thought I should just make that point. The capital underspending in the Treasury, one has got to say this carefully because, you know, sometimes trying to explain something one trips. I indicated in the first instance, the Treasury is not a big capital spending department. I mean, if you look at the money, the bulk will be the transfer. It's money that we just serve as a conduit to passing to the special pensions, SARS, and so on and so forth. First point to make. Secondly, the underspending, the bulk of it relates to what is actually a small project. But of course, if you express it in percentage terms, which is where the percentages don't work, if you're supposed to have two people in a room and one is standing outside, 50% of the people are outside. But in reality, if you then change and say, you know, one person was outside, then the message gets very carries a very different meaning. The understanding relates, and I'm not saying that it's a celebrated thing. It relates to this contract about refurbishing a building that's next door to us. The first time the contractor looked at the work, and the contracting is managed by Public Works, by the way. But it's not something we don't care about because we do want to end up occupying the building. First, there were structural problems with the building that were not detected first time. So only when they then started to do the work, they realized there is more work than originally thought. And therefore, it meant revising the scope of the work and recosting it and so on. That has led to the delays and all difficulties. But the amounts, in reality, in absolute terms, are relatively small. They are not the amounts to cause sleepless nights as it happens with underspending, say, elsewhere. I just want to deal with... I actually think that... I now have left only the questions that relate to state-owned entities.
Thank you, Lungisa. I'll just pick up also where Lungisa has finished around the CapEx, specifically by the state-owned enterprises. What you will see is in the budget review, we publish on an annual basis updates of what expenditure actually took place. But in actual fact, and you will have seen this in the reporting on the asset and liability management program, that we do actually collect that data on a quarterly basis. And what we have been doing is looking at, and specific mention here was made of Eskom, so Medupi and Kusile's capital expenditure, what is happening on those, are we achieving the targets? And if we're not achieving the targets, then looking at what specific interventions are being put in place to get those programs back on track. And with Eskom in particular, we've been working quite hard on that to make sure that there's not delays on programs like Medupi and Kusile. And so as far as we are aware, the programs are on track so that Medupi will, the first units will be being commissioned early next year. And I think also maybe it's worth drawing your attention to the fact that, and maybe Kenneth can talk a little bit more about this, there is also quarterly reports that our local government unit produce that report on the capital expenditure that's taking place in municipalities that you can also draw on to get that information. So I'll talk first on Eskom, seeing as we are already there. In terms of the 60 billion rand loan, firstly, the 20 billion that was allocated last year was part of the 60 billion allocation. So it had been drawn down in three tranches of 10 billion rand, and then 30 billion rand in 2010-11, and then the final 20 billion rand in 2011-12. And it's a 60 billion rand subordinated loan, which means that it would rank behind Eskom's other debts that they've issued. So in the event that Eskom was liquidated, but we're hoping that's not going to be happening, then we'll make sure it doesn't happen. then, you know, the other bond issuances would be paid out first and then only the subordinated loan. And so when we structured this, also the intention behind providing the loan was to provide support and a type of equity-like support to Eskom to strengthen their balance sheet. And so the interest rate that we have charged on this loan, there is an interest rate which is based on the government, the R206 yield rate, and then it's got a spread over the government R206 yield. But that interest rate is only payable in the event that Eskom's credit metrics are sufficiently sound. So the point was not to be charging them interest while they are in a situation where they were struggling to, for instance, service a loan, because it was intended to be an equity-like type of instrument, not to put additional pressure on their cash flows. And, I mean, this was now 2 or 3 years ago when there was a significant pressure around cash flows. What we are expecting to see is that as we move towards the cost-reflective tariffs, and we're already beginning to see this in their financial statements, is that there have been significant improvements both in their cash levels, their capacity to raise finance, and there has been some profitability coming through, which then adds to their equity and strengthens their balance sheet. And as we continue to move along that path towards cost-reflective tariffs, we are expecting to see improvements in their financial metrics and that eventually they will be able to sustain themselves and borrow without guarantee, so they shouldn't continue to be a black hole, I think was the word that was used, and also that they would eventually be able to repay that loan. It is a 30-year loan. Bottomless pit. Okay, so on the DBSA, the 15 billion rand refers to an increase in the callable capital. Well, that is the intention behind it. But in order to actually increase their callable capital requires... So callable capital is like equity, except that it's not equity that we've actually paid across to the DBSA. But maybe a better example to use is, for instance, in the African Development Bank or the IMF. because you refer to the bailout fund, Minister. So in the event that the IMF starts bailing out European countries, then they might make calls or make callable capital from countries to put that money in, so they've actually got the money to bail out European countries. Obviously, the DBSA is not going to be bailing out European countries. But it serves the same purpose as equity. So we were wanting to increase their equity essentially to 20 billion that we had provided, but to actually affect that requires an amendment to the legislation or the DBSA's founding act, because in the legislation it specifies, need to be corrected on the number, but I think it's in the region of 4.8 billion it's specified as that number in the legislation. So at the moment what we have done is we have provided a guarantee to them with the intention of then amending the legislation so that it becomes what's actually callable capital. And the reason for providing this was to improve their capacity to lend. Now, obviously, the DBSA has to lend to municipalities or state-owned enterprises, or they're also undertaking some lending to, say, renewable IPPs, IDZs, etc. But they're lending to institutions that have sound, either sound projects that they're undertaking, so they're generating sufficient revenues to repay the loan, or the institution itself. So the municipality is a sound municipality that's generating revenues, which it collects, and it's able to service the debt. The intention is not for DBSA to be lending to institutions that are not sound, and so we would expect that they're able to collect on the loans that they've made. They're not intended as grants. So when we're talking about the entire infrastructure program and the infrastructure backlogs and some references made to the $110 billion, you know, not all of that is necessarily the DBSA themselves that have to do all of that investment. It would be done in conjunction with the fiscus, having to provide grants like some of the conditional grants that we already provide to those municipalities that are very weak, and even to some of the municipalities that are strong but they are going to be building infrastructure in areas where there are a lot of poor people, to be able to address those backlogs. So it's a combination of both the DBSA lending where there's a sound business case and the fiscus coming in and filling the gap where there are weaknesses in the institutions. On ElixCorp, the $119 million that's referred to on page 211, it's a contingent liability. It's not actually a guarantee that we've provided. Essentially, how it arose is that there was a land claim on ElixCorp's assets, and there was an agreement that was reached with the community that was, there's a deed of settlement that was agreed between the community and ElixCorp and government. And in respect of that, there was a settlement that had to be made. And in the 2012-13 budget, we have made allocations to ElixCorp that basically settle this outstanding liability as well as other outstanding amounts that were owed by ElixCorp or government. In terms of the debt service cost, the 2.6% of GDP was in line with what we had projected. Obviously, it's a function of the amount of debt that we have issued as well as the interest rate that's charged on that debt. And so as the debt levels rise, which is what we are projecting, for instance, this year we're going to be increasing our debt levels, then obviously the debt service cost is going to increase commensurately. And also as the interest rate costs increase, and there's a number of factors that can drive that, so for the moment we have been supported by a lot of foreign investors coming in and supporting our bonds. At the moment they're taking up about 33% of the portfolio. You know, they have really helped drive down the cost of our borrowing. We've seen with the rating downgrade by Moody's, when the yields had eventually stabilized, that the interest rate had gone up by about 20 basis points, so that's pushing up our debt costs. If there are fluctuations and weakening of the exchange rate, then it can make the cost of servicing our foreign debt a bit higher. Luckily for us, our foreign debt is a relatively small part of our portfolio. It's only about 10%. And obviously, we also have a floating rate portfolio, which is linked to inflation. So if there are changes in inflation, then that can also drive interest rate costs. So all of these factors are things that we need to be keeping an eye on and obviously will concern us around, because they will drive the debt service costs. And looking at the debt levels, that's why we are aiming for a picture of fiscal consolidation, so that we don't continue to see debt service costs being one of the fastest growing items on the budget. The debt service costs, they don't include the repayment of the debt. That's included, we have, if you look at the budget review, you'll see there's the gross borrowing requirement and the net borrowing requirement. So the gross borrowing requirement is also to repay or roll over some of the existing debt that we have in the portfolio.
On the strategic sourcing, as was indicated on page 81 there, Honourable Chairperson,
The training on strategic sourcing did in fact start in the year, and we do indicate the numbers as well. But when we started the training, we very quickly realized, for a number of reasons, amongst others the high turnover of officials and so on, that the training needed to be much more comprehensive, covering all the elements of supply chain management, demand management, because as we all know, strategic sourcing is a bit, more sophisticated at that level. So we expanded the training to all areas of supply chain management, and I must say that the initiative that we then started in conjunction with the provinces and public entities as well, has resulted in us having developed a more comprehensive, integrated training strategy. And recently, although it's after the reporting period, in September in fact, the SACWA board actually officially approved the Chartered Institute of Purchasing and Supply, the so-called CIPS application for professional recognition. And that is incorporated. Now this allows supply chain practitioners to register for official training and even studying towards a master's degree. So we're pushing this very hard at the moment, with limited results at the moment. Unfortunately, officials are not very amenable to e-learnership, e-training. We've tried that, so I think, there will have to be an element of enforcement here. And in the promulgation or the review of the new supply chain management they like to attend these isolated venues, but when they have to sit there, the more exclusive the venue, the higher the numbers, and they get these attendance certificates. That's clearly not what we wanted here. So we will also enforce this through sharpening up on the regulations to have an element of enforcement here and not a nice venue attendance of officials walking away not having learned much. Thank you.
Let me just take a few questions. The chairperson has indicated the issue of time, but just so that members don't think that we ignore some of the questions, but I'll be quick on that. The issue of allocations to municipalities that are poor, essentially all the formulae that we use, they would either use profiles of households, in other words, the combined income of people in a household, so those with smaller incomes would receive proportionately more resources than households that are wealthy, so to speak. And or they would then use backlogs, which also are some indication, if you think about it, of the standard of living in an area. If people don't have water connections, proper sanitation, all of those kinds of indicators, then the resource allocation mechanisms would tend to channel more resources towards those to help them catch up a bit. So the minister had asked that I should explain a bit this callable capital issue. Let me illustrate by means of a living example so that it's easier to understand. When the DPSA was established, it was given in cash 200 million, and government indicated commitments to make available 4.8 billion, which is what Ms. Holstead was referring to, in callable capital. That's what was called callable capital. In essence, it indicates to a would-be lender to the DBSA that in the event that the DBSA were to get into trouble, which is not something we anticipate, government would stand ready to assist. It's an insurance or assurance
to the would-be lender, to the tune of 4.8 billion in terms of the time when it was established, fairly easily and quickly. So in a way, the equity-like nature of callable capital that Ms. Horsett was referring to arises from that, because it does mean that it can have access to cash liquidity, which would prop up the balance sheet of the institution. Now, why then, in fact, a very crucial point. From the 200 million cash injection, the DBSA was able to build a loan book, or if you will, you could even call it a balance sheet, because, you know, those who owe it money appear on its asset side as debtors, of between 35 and 40 billion from that 200 million, simply because people understood that this is an institution that its owner, being government, is standing behind, and therefore reading the 200 million that 4.8 could be made available very fairly quickly to prop up that balance sheet. Now, the idea of expanding then the callable capital of the DBSA and the interim arrangement of a guarantee is predicated on that understanding that in the current environment where economies and financial markets are going through a difficult time, and where government wants to expand the infrastructure investment, particularly by municipalities, the main clients of the DBSA, we would like to make sure that the balance sheet of the DBSA is you can call it propped up. There's an indication of that readiness, so that when it goes out to raise capital, those who lend to it take this into account, which has got the effect of reducing the borrowing costs for the DBSA, which then allow it to not only just raise the capital, but also pass that benefit of lower debt raising cost to the borrowers, which is the municipalities in this case. Then,
can I come back to Honourable Harris? I want to make two general points, Chair, that we can debate with Honourable Harris at some stage. One, I think I indicated to him in a debate that the DA and the ANC probably have different worldviews in terms of the economy. So sometimes the questions that come from a particular worldview. Life is seen in a particular way, and economic activity is seen in a particular way. So even in our media, we don't get adequate honesty, if you like, about where do you come from? What is it that you're trying to achieve? So that's part one. Part two, in many of the types of questions that have come up, I think we must distinguish, Jefferson, between debating policy and the choices that we make on the one hand, and talking down the economy. Right? It's dangerous at the moment to talk down the economy. It's in no South African's interest to do that. And it's very important to keep the debate, is this the right way to do things? Is there a different way to do things? And have we done it properly or have we done it inadequately? Which is a fair criticism that government is willing to listen to. But talking down the economy is not helpful in the current challenging environment, both global and local. Then his first point is about, and it exemplifies what I've just said, that the IMF and the World Bank, the narrative has changed in the last few months, and there must be concern about South Africa. South Africa is a small speck on the global stage, and I'm going to try to see if next time I can take Mr. Harris along to these meetings, so you can actually see how insignificant we are. So there's no concerns about the South African economy. In fact, the maps that the IMF would show, and I'll try and get hold of them for you, show South Africa in a reasonably good light. So if you look at fiscal space that different countries have, and there's a map which the MD of the IMF showed at the former meeting of what is called the IMFC, shows that despite what we think are challenges on our side, the IMF says South Africa has modest or medium fiscal space. The rest, some of the countries were in red, which means they have no fiscal space, like Europe. So we're not in Europe's category. And let's remind ourselves, and this is the talking down part, that our debt GDP ratio is still around below 40. and it will not get to even 45 in the next couple of years. Then he makes reference to ratings. And again, see, this is again the talking down part. I just checked, and he might want to do the same, the Wikipedia website on Moody's, for example. It's interesting history, where it started in 1909, and why it's there, and what it does, and what are some of the challenges that even ratings agencies come up with. So in the specific instance we're dealing with in the current environment on S&P, the editorial in the Business Day today might be quite instructive. And this is the point that we made when we met S&P chairperson in Tokyo, which is you were supposed to visit us in November. Why don't you wait until the MTBPS to actually look at our numbers and what we actually do and how stretched are we fiscally? Why anticipate them? Why don't you wait for the ANC conference in December to see what resolutions we take rather than speculating on what will happen and might happen? And it's in those areas that we think that people who sit at a distance shouldn't make political judgments, because these are political judgments. Look at our numbers, and our numbers are fine. In fact, there was quite an interesting debate. Let's also remind ourselves, Chairperson, that we didn't borrow this extra trillion rands because we just wanted to. We did it in order to make sure that this country doesn't suffer the worst when the recession hit us. That's why we borrowed this money. If we had our choice, and if all things were equal, we wouldn't borrow this kind of money, because we were doing fine. We were 5% growth, revenue was flowing in, and we couldn't even spend all the money that we had in 2008 prior to the recession hitting us. Then he makes reference to EU bailout structures and whether South Africa has bailout structures. Well, there's a very simple answer: we don't need any. Then he makes reference to fiscal consolidation versus support for growth, and that is another debate we need to have, because, Chair, we don't have the time now. But if growth was that easy, the world should be able to return itself to 6% growth. If growth was that easy, Africa should be growing at 10%, not 5%. If growth was that easy, China would be sitting just below 8%. It should be back at 11, 12%. So there must be something mystical about growth, despite with my due respect to my colleagues who are economists. Right? And it's not, you don't pick your fingers and deliver growth. But let's look at the budget. We have consistently removed fiscal drag and put money into people's pockets through PIT relief. What's the number for this year? 17 billion or something like that. 13.5 billion rounds. We sustained real growth in expenditure of 2.6-2.7% despite the recession. We've set up this 25 billion rand competitiveness fund. The DG made reference to it earlier, over a six-year period. We've changed the local procurement rules in cooperation with the DTI so that more procurement will take place locally and more production will take place locally. With the SOEs and ourselves, we are investing hugely in economic infrastructure and in social infrastructure. The problem with social infrastructure is our delivery systems are weak, not that the money isn't there. We've provided guarantees, as Ms. Halstead pointed out, to Eskom, to Transnet, and whoever else needed them in order that they could borrow and increase the leverage that SOEs have in order to deliver what they have to deliver. We've expanded the social grants over the last X number of years in order that people have income in their pockets and can spend, and so support household consumption in South Africa. So if you take one example, Chair, such as agriculture in our GDP numbers, and ask the question, how do you double or treble agriculture's contribution? Much of it hasn't got to do with government. It's about what the private sector invests. It's about what they grow and how they profit and how they share the profit with the rest of the country. So we've got to get the magic right, if you like, between the private sector and government, and indeed other role players in society as well. Insofar as incentives for employment is concerned, I know that the DA has a particular axe to grind with us about the subsidy we've talked about before. There are political processes underway. It would be easy to just say, let's go ahead and implement, but that, I think, would compromise both business and labor and create unnecessary difficulties. We prefer to go the consensus route, and hopefully we get there sooner than not. There are other incentives in the system, for example, learnerships that we have, which have been getting increasing subscription. So that shouldn't be a problem. I'm just trying to think of what else. I think with due respect to Honorable Ross also, using words like bottomless pit for Eskom, you know, you wouldn't have any lights if we're so impolite to them. So let's be nice to them. But the bottom line, Chairperson, in respect of say the ratings agency, I've just spoken to the DG. I think it'll be useful for the committee to get a briefing on what is the matrices that these ratings agencies use, what's the methodology, how do they operate, and so on, so that when we have interactions like these, you have the basic information that would help you to engage with us. In terms of the mining industry, the current difficulties are going to create and are creating difficulties for us. They will lower the production in the mining industry. They will lower exports in the economy. They will probably result in job losses as we go forward. And there would be an impact on CIT. What we've got to place into perspective again is that the whole of the mining industry isn't paralyzed by this. There are sections of the mining industry. And, I mean, the appeal that Parliament, your committee chairperson, and all of us need to make is for the strengthening of the labor relations system so that workers do believe that they have a channel through which they can address their points of view and grievances. And we do need to get the mines working sooner rather than later. In terms of, this is Honorable Ntepo's question, investors, sorry.
Speak through me, Madame. Allow the minister to complete. As much as Mutatwa didn't ask the question, whoever asked the question was on behalf of the committee. Okay.
Oh, no, sorry, I got the wrong name. My apologies, my apologies. Heckling is fine. We do need to create a climate of confidence, both for internal investors and external investors. It was Honorable Chabalala, sorry, my apologies. And again, Chairperson, under your leadership, we need to work out how all of us make a contribution to creating a climate of confidence in South Africa. And the confidence just doesn't come from the so-called political disputes we have in this country. There is really a terrible investment climate around the world. There is hesitation, because the confidence issue doesn't arise because of the strikes or because the ANC is going to a conference, as some would suggest in this room. It's been there since 2008, 2009, since the recession came along. And so people are asking the question, do I invest now because I'm not sure what will happen to Europe next and whether there's going to be another shockwave that will actually come our way and how will it impact on our economy? Notwithstanding that, we need to point to the positives, and there are many positives for South Africa and many opportunities that South Africa has as well in Africa and elsewhere. And the question is, the point I made earlier on, how do we gather ourselves and become cohesive enough, notwithstanding differences in worldviews or something else, in order to seize those opportunities in the national interest? And how do we put national interest first as opposed to party political interest? Are some of the questions that when we have time, Chairperson, under your guidance, we can actually debate. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister and your team.
Can I just add one thing? Sure. If you want to talk about the impact of the ratings agencies and so on, I just got an SMS Today's bond auction saw strong demand. We were, as usual, looking to raise 2.1 billion rands. We received 7.3 billion rands in bids. Okay? So if we were this absolute mess that some of us would like to suggest, would people be offering you 7.3 billion rands to borrow from them?
Thanks. Honorable members, I know you might still be wanting to make a follow-up on some of the questions that you have raised, but because of time, but also just to remind you that on the fiscal framework issues, this is a report back in terms of progress that has been made. This committee will be engaging with the medium-term budget policy statement immediately it is presented next week. So we'll have an opportunity to compare that which has been presented and that which has been achieved and the projections into the future. So we still have got a platform through which we can engage on a number of issues. Unless it's DG, yeah. So I thought I should make that comment. But I also think I should just commend the department for the report back, comprehensive report back that you've shared with us in terms of your strategic plans and annual plan that you presented and adopted by this committee. Moving forward, just on the number of issues that you have raised with us here, in terms of the audit outcomes, as we deal with the annual plans, I mean the annual report, I think you might have observed, DG, that in terms of National Treasury, for the past two financial years, although you have received unqualified reports with findings, nothing has changed for the past 2 years. It remains the same. I think it's an area that we need to look into at some point. In fact, the stagnation in that area, there is a stagnation in the past 2 years compared to 2009 and 2010, in my own assessment. I agree with the minister that at some point we may need to sit down with the probably committees of finance appropriations just to get a report back in terms of interventions as a follow-up to what Honorable Adams raised earlier on. But it's not more about what has happened, it's what experiences have we drawn out of that, including probably what role Parliament should be able to play in assisting and the model of interventions. Because sometimes we put, or government, puts National Treasury in a very invidious position. The assumption that there is capacity to deal with all the challenges throughout the country. And in your report, DG, you indicate that 5% of the vacancies exist because of declines to take offers, either through remuneration packages or whatever conditions, either counter offers from other sectors of the economy. Now, if we don't address that capacity within National Treasury, will continue to experience lots and lots of problems. The third point is in relation to the training in municipalities. I think we need to have a report that quantifies the impact of the training that has gone through at that level. Because you also have the DBSA that does the same thing in terms of municipalities and so on and so forth. Probably for the last 18 years, that's one area that lots of money has actually gone into in terms of training. The impact may not be felt because of the turnover of councillors also. As you train people, they move out, you know. Even at the level of management, as you train people, gets deployed elsewhere. Sometimes a mismatch of where people are actually deployed within the system itself. So that impact cannot be felt or may not be felt. So it's important that we look into that. Now, why I speak of experiences out of the interventions? You look at some of the national departments, they are struggling on their own just to deal with their own internal issues. Then you give them an added responsibility to go and assist in other provinces
we set them for failures. So what systems do you put in place to support those kind of departments to assist in that area? The last point, Minister, is I'm actually surprised that none of the members has picked it up. Is the issue of SAA. It's not part of the annual report back, but it's a topical issue today. And I just find the Minister and the Department quite defensive on this matter. It's not a bailout, it is what? It is a recapitalization, it's not a bailout and all those kind of things. But what worries me and what concerns me is that as National Treasury moves in to assist, you also see the captain and the entire crew. You know? Captain and entire crew leaving the ship. You know? If it's a pilot and the entire crew, they leave the plane airborne with the passengers inside. Now we don't know. They can parachute themselves out of that situation. Now, I am just concerned about that situation, and I don't know what mechanisms and plans do we have to make sure that as we intervene, we are not going to get a report later on that says, remember, as we're intervening, management was leaving, and that's the situation. We don't want to come into that kind of a situation later on. So it will be important that at some point we have a sense of what is it that is actually happening in that area. It might be a public enterprise issue, but the finances are approved at this level. On a lighter note, you know, the issue of labor unrest raised by Honorable Chabalala, and when I read the documents here, I actually say we might reach a situation where even when you want to say, let's strike a balance between this and this, you then have to say, I can't say strike. You say, let's find a balance between this and that. Yeah. Thanks, Minister, and your team.
Can I just, before anybody thinks we're ducking the SAA issue, there has been a process of interaction between the Minister of Public Enterprises and ourselves on SAA. I think they do have some difficulties in terms of sorting out some of the management issues, but they also face, and in fairness we must be careful, that it faces, when we sit on the southern tip of Africa, you have a huge number of disadvantages. One is distance, long distance flights, the cost of fuel, which has been jumping around. And that location at the southern tip of Africa means you can do certain things well, and you can't do other things that other airlines are actually doing. Then it's the nature of the aeroplanes that they have and whether they cost fuel efficient enough or not, and these seem to change every so often. We've agreed with the Minister of Public Enterprises that we want to see a clear strategy. There's been a diagnostic, if you like, that has been done. Colleagues in the Treasury are aware of that and have been tracking those developments. We also look forward to the new strategy because that must address some of these questions. And at the same time, if there are inefficiencies in terms of financial management or operational management within SAA, we hope that those will be dealt with as well. But when you just think about it, honourable members, if you were managing something that's sitting at the southern tip of Africa, and then think about, you know, traveling either to New York on the one side or, as I've been, to Tokyo on the other side, what does it take and how cost-effective are these things and do we need to run them or not and so on and so on. So I think it'll be useful, perhaps in partnership with the Public Enterprise Department, to have an interaction with yourselves on that. And may I thank all the members for the excellent questions and interaction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, honourable members. This is sitting at 2 o'clock. I'll be taking a register and marking who's in, who's not in. Thanks, Minister, and your team.